G'day and welcome to Macca's Podcast. I love the scope of our program, anything and everything. If you want to get in touch with Australia, this is the place to do it. Settle back and join the Australian phone box. See you on the road.
Get on with it, Macca.
G'day, this is Macca.
Well, g'day, Macca, Ian Francis. I'm in Auckland.
Oh, g'day, Ian. Dr. Ian, what are you up to in Auckland?
Well, I've got just a one morning of lectures by a guy called Professor David Zee, from Baltimore, and he's a legend in eye movement disorders, movements of the eyes.
Uh-huh. And this is an international conference, is it?
Yeah, people from, he's the only international one, but a couple of guys from Australia came and all the rest of New Zealanders, because it was organised by a lady called Professor Dame, she's like a sir, she's a dame, professor of ophthalmology in Auckland, called a lovely lady called Helen Danish Meyer. She's a friend of David Zee, who's, I guess, visiting New Zealand for a bit of a trip, and he gave a fantastic morning of lectures on eye movements.
And what should we know about them?
Well, you can diagnose many things. You can diagnose dietary deficiencies, cancer, alcohol poisoning, B1 deficiency, bowel troubles, you name it, you can diagnose it. And brain tumours, of course.
I've always sort of read that the eye, eye is the sort of mirror of the body in lots of ways. Well, yeah, I'm not an eye person, but that's what I've heard said. So it's true, and I suppose they're finding out more and more as the years go by with more research.
Yeah. Well, the neuroanatomy of it's very complex. But it's very enjoyable to look at someone's eyes or visual system, eye movements, and tell them what's wrong with them. It's great.
Well, maybe not for the people who are getting the diagnosis, but I suppose it's better to know than not to know, isn't it?
Well, if you know what's wrong with yourself, then whether it can be treated or whether it can't be, and helps you know how to live.
Yeah, and I suppose when the eye's indicating something, then you can do a bit of research and say, well, look, we've checked that, and it's... it might not always be true, I suppose, but if the eye's saying that, it's a good way to a good point of start, isn't it?
Certainly is. It's great. So wonderful. So I had a lot of fun. Went to a restaurant last night in a place called Parnell, which I think is a pretty nice part of Auckland, called Non Solo Pizza. And I actually speak a bit of Italian, and I didn't really pick up on that. It means not only pizza. And they had terrific meals, great pizzas, and lots of beef and various types of meats, and it's terrific.
Was it expensive? I bet it was.
Well, we were being taken for dinner, so I've got no idea.
Non solo pizza, non meaning none, solo meaning on its own, and
pizza. Yeah.
Yeah,
I didn't even pick up on that. I sort of feel a bit dopey, actually.
Yeah, last time I was in Auckland, we went over to Auckland for to do an Anzac Day program about 10 years ago maybe, and and we went out for dinner one night, and we went into this restaurant, and it was hugely expensive, so we left because it was ridiculous. It must have been a high-end restaurant. That is 10 years ago at least, so we thought we weren't going to afford that, because it was about $80-$90 for a main meal and all that sort of stuff. So
that's ridiculous. Yeah, well, this is much less than that, but it was very nice to go out and be taken out. And I had a great time. And Helen Danish Meyer is a lovely person, lovely family. She's great.
And you tend to go to these conferences all over the place, which I suppose is good fun and interesting. But
it is great. I've been to last time we talked. I was at Uluru, I think. And then where am I going? I'm going to Coolangatta to the Sea World. There's a conference up there pretty soon.
Well,
I'm giving a talk.
Sounds good, Ian. The eyes have it, eh?
The eyes do it. The eyes and the brains, really.
All right, good on you.
They were connected recently. Okay, Macca, nice to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, mate. Bye. Good day. This is Macca.
Good morning, Macca. It's Kelly Howlett from Port Hedland reporting in from Kona in Hawaii.
Hi, Kelly. Tell us, what are you doing there?
We've been attending an international sea turtle symposium, the 44th. It's been held here in Hawaii, and we've joined over 865 other participants from 63 other countries, and we've been putting our Port Hedland flatback turtles firmly on the map here.
Well, tell us all about it. What do you do in Port Hedland, Kelly?
Yeah, so I am the operations manager with Care for Headland Environmental Association. So we're a local community grassroots organisation. And from October to February, we monitor flatback turtles. And I was here at the symposium. I provided an 8-minute presentation on our program. And last night at the awards ceremony, we were awarded the Grassroots Conservation Award. So it was a humbling and amazing honour.
I'll say you've come a long way from Hawaii to Port Hedland, or vice versa.
Yes, it is it's a long way. So we're slowly beginning the journey back. It's Saturday morning here time in Hawaii, and we're slowly beginning the long swim back.
That'd be right. Tell me about the turtle story. A turtle symposium from people from all over the place, all over the world.
Yeah, it was amazing, like, to have so many different countries and so many jurisdictions. And, you know, in Australia, we're fairly blessed in terms of, you know, political stability, in terms of resourcing. To hear some of the other challenges that people from, you know, whether it's Myanmar, whether it's Venezuela, Costa Rica, you know, the challenges they have compared to the challenges we have, you know, worlds apart. But we're all dealing with the same thing, trying to do conservation in a changing world and, yeah, just trying to get our research out there, get our information out there. And, yeah, it's just humbling to be surrounded by so many people all doing fantastic work.
Now, you've been telling me, what, the flatback turtle story. How many, I haven't got a clue. How many varieties of turtles are there in the world that you, you know, discuss at the symposium?
Yeah, there's 7 sea turtles worldwide, and we're lucky in northwest Western Australia. We get 6 of them, so we're very fortunate. But in Port Hedland, we just get the flatback turtles. So for everyone else in the world, flatback turtles are restricted just to the Australian waters, and so they all have to come to Australia to see flatbacks. So, you know, they love the uniqueness. They love that Aussie, you know, contribution at these conferences. And I think we got a lot of people wanting to come to Port Hedland from the conference.
Yeah, I love Port Hedland, actually. I haven't been there for, I don't know, 10 years, really. We were on our way around Australia. We went to Karratha and Port Hedland. It's just, I don't know what it is. I just loved Port Hedland. I always wanted to get back there. So maybe sometime, Kelly.
Yeah, well, please come back this October. You can be part of our turtle season launch, so it'd be wonderful for you to be a part of it. This year's our 23rd year.
So your turtles, what, they come to Port Hedland to lay eggs and all that sort of stuff? Is that the story, or what's the story?
Yeah, they nest. They nest from October through till usually the end of January, and we get hatchlings from the end of November through till, you know, sometimes February's, depending on the weather and cyclones. So it's 45 days from when the eggs are laid to when hatchlings emerge.
Okay, Kelly. Well, nice to talk to you this morning. And I hope, hope you have a safe swim back to Australia. Is there any, what's the feeling around in Hawaii about what's going on in the Middle East? Do people talk about that, or?
Yeah, look, people aren't talking about it too much. I think everyone's just, you know, continuing to watch the news. There are some of the participants here at the symposium that can't go back straight away, particularly Saudi Arabia and Jordan. So, yeah, it is hard when you see different things happening. Here in Hawaii, they're predicting there might be some volcanic activity. So we're hoping that that's a nice tourist look and nothing else.
All right, Kel, nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. G'day, this is Macca. Dave's on the line. Where are you, Dave?
Macca, I'm in Newtown, which is part of Hobart, Tasmania.
How's things in Hobart, mate, in Tassie?
It's a beautiful place, but remarkably dry. I've not had to even, I need to water the lawns even at the moment and water the plum trees so that all the fruit fills out. And that's been similar across most of Tasmania, that Tasmania is well under average rainfall to an extent where the Hydroelectric Commission, which has a lot of water storages and generates electricity for the whole of Tasmania, has been short of water to an extent where they've needed to import a certain amount of electricity from the mainland.
It's funny, isn't it? I was talking about this the other day to somebody, and we were talking about rain, but I've been here doing this program for a good while, and it's routinely, you always think, I mean, you think of Tassie as the Apple Isle and it's green and things like that, but every other year there's been a drought, not right around Tassie, but, you know, I'll be in the Midlands and people say, oh, it's been dry here. I think we get the wrong impression of Tassie in terms of weather. There's always seems to be some drought, you know, every other year in Tassie, but you're saying this one is pretty widespread across Tassie this year and last year.
Yes, it is widespread, but it's been magical weather for tourists, Macca. you'd have been able to sit out in the sun without getting over hot, of course, compared with parts of the mainland.
Yeah, well, that's the problem is, of course, that's pretty serious when you're short of water and you depend on, you know, it's a great way to make your electricity if you've got some hydro, but if you haven't got any water, you've got no electricity.
Well, we've got two areas of long-term storage down the southwest, around the Gordon River, and up around the Great Lake, and both those storages store, roughly speaking, at least a year's supply of water, whereas other places are little more than perhaps a week or two as they run down the river.
Yeah, well, you can't. The bloke said to me a couple of years ago, the weather is unpredictable and it has no memory. So just because you've got a drought one year doesn't mean it's going to rain the next year. You could have another drought the next year around. It's, the weather's great. That's why we always talk about the weather, Dave. Everybody does when you meet them in the street or whatever. It's a great conversation starter, isn't it?
It certainly is. And I've enjoyed listening to you and your program for somewhere around between 40 and 50 years. Probably 50 years.
No, not 50. Well, not that
long. Over 40.
Yeah, something about that. Yeah, about that, Davey. All right, well, I hope you get some rain, but you never know, do you? What's that?
And one last thing briefly, Macca. I've got a speech to prepare for my rostrum club next week.
Yep.
And I've got to look at the topic and prepare it, and I do this fairly regularly. And Rostrum's an organisation that has clubs all over Australia, about 95 clubs, Western Australia, Victoria, north of Queensland. And it's a great organisation in helping younger people develop their skills might be for a job interview, might be to become an announcer like you. You've got a great technique.
Yes, well, it's a great thing, and I find that because kids are glued, well, not just kids, glued to their mobile, you don't have to talk so much, but it's very important to be able to talk and get up in front of people and say whatever you do, maybe write a speech and then speak off the cuff. I think that's the best thing too, rather than read a speech. If you can memorise some points and just talk off the cuff, that's the best way, rather than having to... I mean, it's all right now. You've got those electronic things where you can, you know, the little ball bounces and you can read something off screens, and a lot of people do that. But it's really the best, I think, and it just seems more natural if you can learn what you're doing or just a few dot points and then talk to your topic. But it's a great, Rostrum. I haven't been to Rostrum, but I know people who have, and it's you know, it's very reassuring for people when someone gets up and they can, you know, handle what they're talking about and looks natural and stuff like that. So I hope you get lots of young kids in there, and because it's fairly daunting to stand up in front of people when you're young and you know, address them.
Well, we've got Rostrum originally was set up for adults 100 years ago, but we in the last 30-odd years, we've also run a speaking competition for school children in two age groups, kind of under 18 and under 14, I think. But and that's the Voice of Youth competitions run in different states, well, in every state, but with a national final in different states each year. So broadly speaking, we have 1,000 students to start with, and we end up with... Was it six or seven by two students a dozen for the national final towards the end of the year. And it's a great experience for them.
I bet it is. A bit daunting too. Good on you, Dave. Nice to talk to you, mate. Thank you.
And you, Macca.
Thanks, mate. Bye. Trevor's in Broken... Oh, Trevor. Our Skywatcher, Trevor in Broken Hill. Good morning, Trevor.
Good morning, Macca.
How was the Blood Moon, as they called it?
It was... Well, the start of that night was wall-to-wall cloud, but when it approached totality, there was a clear patch, and from Broken Hill, we actually did see the Blood Moon.
Uh-huh. And is that exciting for people like you, or is it just another night on the telescope?
Well, I've seen, many times over the years total eclipses of the moon, so it wasn't really a big deal for me.
Mm.
But it's great that it encourages people who maybe never look at the night sky or look at it rarely to go out and have a look. So in that respect, it's really a great thing.
Yeah, I think so too. And young kids seem to me to be very, I suppose because they see it on their phone, and there's so many apps now they can look at things on their phone. So they get a bit excited about that, and I suppose it's a bit different to the normal thing on the when they're just talking to people about, what they're going to wear or whatever, and then all of a sudden something like that happens, and they, got to understand it, that the Earth's gone between the moon and the sun, and, that's the end of the story. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. So anything that encourages, especially young people, to look at the night sky, like this last year during Science Week, I went to our local high school for the whole week and gave presentations on astronomy, but things that I thought would encourage them, young people to actually think about something other than the screens of their phones, and to wander outside occasionally and look at the night sky. We have an excellent place to do that out here at Broken Hill, Macca. I mean, we're 1,000 kilometres west of Sydney. The weather systems that cross our continent, the high pressure systems often track inland and often pass over Broken Hill. And that gives us really stable air. And so people can walk outside, and it's just, the stars don't twinkle on a good night out here because the atmosphere is that steady. It's a terrific place to look at the night sky and enjoy what's up there to see.
Now, have you seen any of the weather that's around with monsoons? I mean, I know there's been a lot of weather in the Cooper Basin and stuff like that. You're probably a bit far away from it, but there's a lot of rain around. What's happening in the hill?
Oh, Macca, you wouldn't believe what it's dished up this year for us. We had 9 consecutive days of mid to high 40s, topping out at 48 degrees.
Wow.
And then that was followed by a red dust storm, which arrived at dusk. That was immediately followed by maybe about 3 or 4 mil of rain. And then we had 8 days of rain. And, I mean, Broken Hill, we're flat out getting 200 mil a year. Well, in an 8-day period following the heat wave, we got about 250 mil of rain. Can you believe that? My bowling greens, I'm the greenkeeper at my bowling club,
uh-huh.
Astronomer greenkeeper, I say,
uh-huh.
And you wouldn't believe the rate that the grass is growing. Yeah, it's incredible.
Well, it is. I don't know. It must be the time of the year, but I've not noticed that before. But everybody, you see people out mowing the lawns, and you mow them, and then, 3 days later, they've grown an inch. It's just, I suppose it's the humidity and the temperatures. It's just the right conditions for the lawns to grow nuts. They're growing in Broken Hill. They're growing at my place, for God's sake, around your ankles. It's just, I haven't noticed that before, but maybe, I don't know. It's just the conditions, the very conditions, the humidity, the temperature, and a bit of rain around the place, and whooshka, away they go.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Trevor, good on you, mate. Nice to talk to you.
No worries, Macca.
Always keep in touch, mate.
Not a problem.
G'day, this is Macca.
G'day, Macca. It's Brendan Rinjapa, Japan.
Where are you, Brendan? In
the township's Furano. It's a ski village. There's a population of about 20,000. I'm just visiting.
Uh-huh.
We've got like four Toyota dealers here. That's about 5,000 people per Toyota dealer.
Well, that's what you would have in, because I assume they sell lots of Toyotas in Japan, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They don't get stolen much either. There's not much crime. You don't even really lock the front door here. We put our beer on the kitchen ledge to keep it cool. No one takes it.
Now, I didn't know. What are the cars most stolen in Australia? Usually you hear they're stealing Porsches and stuff like that because they're using them as getaway cars. But are you implying that Toyotas are stolen quite a bit in Australia or what?
Well, generally, the crime here is quite lower than what I would experience back in Brisbane, that's for sure, yeah.
Well, that's good. Isn't that good? I wonder how they manage that. Are the people just more law-abiding or is there laws in place to make it not a good idea to start stealing things?
Yeah, probably a bit of both. But the culture's pretty good. They all sort of work on a bit of a melody around here. You cross the road one way, there's a certain tune. If you want to cross in a different direction, the pedestrians get another tune.
So you've been there before to Furano and Japan, Brendan, have you?
Yeah, I've been to Japan about 12 years ago. This is the first time I've come up this far north to where the skiing is.
Uh-huh. And it's winter. It's the end of winter over there, is it? Or what?
Yeah, another month of the season, and that's about it. I think it warms up to about 26 degrees in summer. But, yeah, in winter she's pretty cold. You know you're this far north when all the satellite dishes point towards the horizon.
Well, I don't. I've not been to Japan, but everybody tells me about it. And as I said, it's the place that's being loved to death by tourists. I don't know what people like about it, but they like it. Is it because it's clean, because the food's good, because people are polite, all those sort of stuff, all those sort of things, I think, Brendan. I'm not sure. What's your take?
Yeah, exactly. It's a great place. For that, and everyone's sort of very well respected with everyone. My brother, he's bought a place up here in the village. It's a four-bedroom house, $180,000.
Wow. Tell me more.
Well, he's a pensioner now of the age, and so they can ski at quite a cheap rate. In fact, there's a bloke's about 80 years of age. He's on the ski fields every day. I saw him yesterday. Mm. But, yeah, he picked up a second-hand fridge, second-hand washing machine, all come with the user manuals. Even the $20 second-hand toaster came with the manual as well. So everything's tidy, organised, predictable. It's pretty good.
I wonder how they do that. And everything here seems to be a mess, it seems to me. I don't know. But, yeah, people are just scratching their heads about Australia. I mean, it's a lovely country and it's our country, but I don't know. It could go better. But Japan sounds like the model for the rest of us to follow.
Yeah, or maybe it's because they sleep a lot in the trains and stuff. When I was here last...
Really? Tell me, what are they all asleep on the train, are they? This is on the fast train or just normal trains?
Oh, if you don't want to watch any of the 36 displays that are in the train carriage, you can have a sleep and then you'll hear the melody of the train station to recognise your stop and you know how to get off by the tunes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, here's my. They're playing a whole lot of shaking going on. That's my tune. Oh, there's a bit of Taylor Swift. Yes, that's my station. Yeah, and you wake up. So, crazy, Brendan.
I played a bit of Peter Allen here for my daughter, which was a Still Call Australia Home song.
Yeah.
And she had a tear in her eye, you know, as she sort of thought back about Australia from here and far with the. It was one of the airline videos.
Uh huh. So, Brendan, how long – so you've got family over there, have you?
Yes, this time of year my brother tends to stay here for the season and then we'll head back to Australia. I'm here for probably about a week and then I'm off to China to do a bit of work and then I'll be back in Brizzy.
To do a bit of what?
A bit of work. What do you... all supplies parts there for the electric scooter stuff in China.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, that's and how's that going? The bikes are all over Sydney, of course. People just ride these bikes and leave them anywhere, and then I don't know. Does that happen in Japan?
No, well, you can't even, like, if you're on an electric scooter here in Japan, you'll have a number plate on the back of the thing.
Mm.
And even, like, if you're on a bicycle in Tokyo, you can't ride with headphones on. It's illegal to ride with headphones on. You've got to be mindful of those around you. So, totally different culture, Macca.
Yeah, well, it's just that it's lawless here. I mean, and nobody wants to, like, premiers and stuff like that don't want to enforce it. We have bike lanes for bikes. But, of course, they were invented 20 years ago or 30 years ago when people were actually riding bikes. But now they've got these e-bikes and I assume people have been knocked down by them, but they're doing 40 k's an hour sometimes along bike trails, for God's sake. And people here are riding on footpaths, doubling people. I mean, I had a motorbike when I was 18 and I couldn't double anyone for a year. But now people are doubling everywhere on these e-bikes, and yeah, there's no laws and nobody wants to enforce it. I don't know what the story is, but you need bicycles are one thing, but electric and motorized bicycles are completely another thing. I don't know what the hospital stats are. Somebody will have the stats, even insurance companies, about accidents involving bicycles and e-bikes and things.
We had a report handed over in Queensland from a six-month committee parliamentary review, and one of the things they're going to look at doing is crushing them, requiring licences, and change some of the ages as well. So there'll be some changes happening in Queensland. But, yeah, it's the people doing the wrong thing, and you guys, you know, you just don't do it, really.
Mm, exactly. Yeah, well, Japan sounds like the model for the rest of us, but there's no need for change from politicians. They don't want to make any change unless they're forced to, unless there's votes in it, all those sort of things. People only do things, it seems to me, political parties of all persuasions only do things if there's votes in it or there's not votes. They're not going to lose votes. So I don't know. But Japan, no wonder people go to Japan. And the food's good. You like the food?
I love the food, yeah.
A mate of mine just came back. He said, "Where have you?" He said, "I've been in Japan." He said, "I only stayed a week," because he said, "I can't stand the food." And I said, "Surely they've got McDonald's there or something." He said, "Oh yeah, but you can't eat McDonald's all the time." Anyway, yeah. Anything else to report, Brendan?
Nothing much. I might give you an update if we find anything notable in China next week, and it'd be good to be back in Australia.
Okay, good on you, mate. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Macca.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
G'day, this is Macca.
Oh, g'day, Macca. It's Scott Turner here.
Hi, Scott.
How you going?
Yeah, good. Scott,
that's the way.
You've just returned from the Middle East. Is that right? Tell me your story, Scott.
Yeah, Macca, I got in last night about midnight.
Mm-hmm.
Flew back from Dubai, left there early Saturday morning about 2 a.m.,
Was it scary to be in Dubai? What were you doing in Dubai?
I was over there working. I was up in a place called Ras Al Khaimah, which is an hour and a half north of Dubai. We're working on a very large resort that's being built up there. And I go up once a month, spend a week, 10 days up there, excuse me, and got caught up in the action.
Yes, that's the United Arab Emirates, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
There's Ras Al Khaimah is one of the five or six Emirates, and it's about an hour and a half north of Dubai.
Ras Al Khaimah. Now, Scott, was it scary? What was happening around your area? And you wanted to come back because you thought it was unsafe?
Well, I was due to come back last Wednesday, as it was. My flight got cancelled on Wednesday, got cancelled on Thursday, got cancelled on Friday, and I was lucky enough to get on the first scheduled flight out on Saturday morning. There was a later flight on Saturday, but that got cancelled. I don't know if you knew, but there was a missile strike on Dubai Airport yesterday morning, and it was very close to the terminal, and just how there was no aeroplanes or no damage to the terminal is beyond me.
Uh-huh. So you were scared, I suppose, where you wanted to come home?
Well, as I said, I was coming home because I was due to come home. There was a lot of missile action the whole time we're up there, every day. And where Ras Al Khaimah is, it's on the missile trajectory that goes from Iran to, the way we could work it out, looked like Bahrain. And every day we were counting missiles, and you know, there's 20 or 30 missiles going overhead that were all intercepted by the UAE military. A lot of explosions, the debris falling down into the little village where we live. There was missile debris falling down into the village. It was, you know, it's real. It's a real war.
I'll say. Now, a lot of Aussies over there in the UAE, in Ras Al Khaimah, is it Ras Al Khaimah and things like that? Lots of Aussies over there living there and working there?
Yeah, well, the building site that I'm working on, it's a large site. It's probably one of the larger projects that's being built in the Middle East at the moment. There's 18,000 people working on the site.
Holy mackerel.
And of the 18,000, there's... Most of those people are labourers that come from places like India and Pakistan, but there are a lot of expat Australians, South Africans, English working there. And so, yeah, there's quite a few Aussies there.
Are they expressing concern that they want to come home?
It's a funny situation. Everyone's anxious because of what's going on. There's certainly people are, you know, if the people who wanted to get out can get out. And to put that into context, last night on the flight coming home, the plane was half full. It wasn't a full flight by any means. And I found that very surprising. I just didn't understand why the plane wasn't full. And I put that down probably to either people being reluctant to go to the airport or not wanting to leave or leaving by other means, either going to Oman or some of the other places you can get out of.
Yeah, or maybe they thought there'd be no chance of getting on a plane or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. It was a very strange situation. But I was very thankful. My wife was very, very thankful to see me when I got in last night. And it's very nice to be home.
So that's quite a long flight. You left from Dubai. And where do you land on the way home? I suppose you do somewhere.
No, non-stop Dubai, straight through to Sydney, about a 13-hour flight.
Oh, that's all right then. That's not too bad. Nice to be home, Scott. And you work all around the world, don't you? I mean, you do these sort of things. Because I remember talking to your dad years ago from Turner Brothers, the old company in Cogra, Roger, your father. And he was working, I think at the time he was working in Hong Kong or somewhere with casinos, and you do all the internal fittings and all that sort of stuff. Is that what you're doing in Dubai?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We do the curtains, and we've done curtain. We were working for one of the big American casino companies in Dubai, and we've been working up there for 20 years, and the same company that we did the work for in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, we're now doing work for in the Middle East. They're building the first integrated resort, which is another word for a casino and a hotel. It's a 1,600 room. It's a huge project, 70 stories, and
it's beyond. I suppose until you go to somewhere like Dubai and you haven't seen it, you just don't get an idea of what's happening in the other part of the world. Australia seems like a sleepy hollow in lots of ways, but to people who are here, things. Lee, look at all the high-rise we've got here in Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane. But compared to what's going on in places like Dubai, Scott, it must be a head-turner for you too.
Well, it's where we are in Ras Al Khaimah. It's a village. I would describe it being a little bit like Sanctuary Cove on the coast, and then off the coast is an island that they've built that's a bit like the Sovereign Islands. At on the island, there's the resort that we're working on. On top of that, they're building about 3,500 room hotels. It's pretty incredible. And then on the land, just back where the island comes to the land, they're building 23,000 apartments. And all that's happening in the space of 12 or 18 months. There's a lot going on over there.
And is that for people who live there, or is that for people like people who are moving to Dubai from all over the world to live there for some, I don't know why he'd live there. Like, it gets very hot there, doesn't it? But is that what these apartments are for people who want to live in Dubai or for locals?
It's a bit of both. People who live in Dubai tend to go outside of Dubai for weekends, and this place is an hour and a half north, and so a lot of people come up there for weekends. Also, you get a lot of Russians who come in to escape the cold weather. And so it's primarily a tourist destination rather than anything else.
Oh, Scott, well, look, it's good you're home, mm-hmm. and I bet you're pleased to be home, but there'll be no idea when you go back, I suppose.
Well, I'm due to go back in about 3 weeks. Whether that happens at the moment, I guess it's in the lap of the gods, depending on just how things go. And, you know, as I said, the situation is real. There's a lot of action up there with respect to missiles flying both, you know. It was funny yesterday, they were saying that the Iranian government had said that they were apologising for the missile strikes that they made against their UAE neighbours. But as that happened, the missiles were dropping onto the Dubai airport. So it's yeah. a funny situation.
Oh, well, it's not, you know, yeah. All's fair in love and war, and this truth's the first victim, casualty in wartime, mate. So you don't believe what anyone says from any side, really. But certainly, yes, it's a strange regime, the Iranian regime at the moment. Why you would attack your neighbours who have done nothing to you, really. But I suppose, as I say, all is fair in love and war. Scott Turner, great to talk to you, mate. And thanks for the call. And we'll keep in touch. Good on you, mate.
Cheers, thanks.
See you, bye. Amazing world. G'day, this is Macca.
Good morning, Macca. It's Jonathan Dixon.
In Melbourne,
Macca, yes.
How are you, mate?
Yeah, very good. Look, I was looking and I saw Engelbert Humperdinck was coming back to do some singing, and I thought I'd tell you, being a muse, you'd get a bit of a kick out of the story. I had an experience with him. And I'll just start it off quickly. In late 60s, I was passing through England, and that was when he was just starting off, and I went to the Hammersmith Odeon.
Oh, yeah.
And saw him there. And then fast forward about 20 years later, I decided to take my wife to Turtle Island, which was it's an island in the Pacific, for a rest. And it was for 12 people. And we all sat round a table, 12 couples. And everyone introduced themselves. There were a couple of gangsters from New York with them, with their moles. A couple of Italians. And then sitting next to me, I had a guy, and I thought, I think I know you. Anyway, he introduced himself. His name was John Pertwee. And they said, well, what do you do? And he said, well, I'm Doctor Who. and I thought...
And you said, Doctor Who?
Well, I'd do it. You know, Doctor Who. Anyway, we were there for 14 days, got to know him very well. And the reason why I'm telling the story is that he had used to have a nightclub in England, and we were talking about people, and he said, look, I first gave Engelbert his break. Actually, his name was Jerry Dorsey when he used to sing for me. Anyway, we got on very, very well. And again, fast forward, a friend of mine at a radio station here rang me, John Sammy Newman. He said, Deco, he said, I've got Engelbert in town. He wants to play golf. Would you mind playing with him? And I said, well, not at all. So we went down to Royal Melbourne, and it just shows you with these people. I mean, he was internationally very big. I suppose he still is. And all the girls came out, wanted all, they fussed over him, and they did this. So I said to the guys, now, listen, we're not talking anything about music. Let him just have a good game of golf and relax. Well, anyway, we've started on the first hole, and my friend Titch Walker hit his ball into the bunker. And we're standing there waiting for him to hit out, and he's all of a sudden broken into this huge rendition of Please Release Me. Well, old Engelbert nearly fell over.
Don't you hate that when you're a star? Yeah, anyway, go on.
Ah, listen. But he turned out to be an absolute great bloke. And the interesting thing was he wore two gloves. And I said, what's the bit with two gloves? And he said, call me Eng, by the way. What's the two gloves? And he said, well, it was summer. And he said, well, I can't have one hand sunburned and the other not. I thought, Jesus. And he wouldn't drink out of the water fountains. Then you did, you know, because he said, no, I can't. I said, you're thirsty? There's the water. Turn it on. He said, no. He had his own special water. Anyway, it was just a story. I thought, you as a muso and me as an ex-muso, mate, I got a bit of a kick out of.
and his nickname, he says, call me Eng, as in Engelbert.
He said, call me Eng.
Well, there you go. Well, see, he's out. I think he's out here in a month or two or something.
He's coming out in July. But he was a terrific bloke, and when we played for money, a little bit of money, and when we finished, we had to sign the note, the Australian note. He said, because I keep this under a table at my place, and we said, oh, that's pretty neat, and I said, and what club do you belong to there? And he said, well, I've got my own course. And I thought, yeah, of course. How stupid asking that sort of question. His own course at his house.
And he's a fair age now, and he's still doing it. And, he's Dorsey, that's right. He's named Jerry Dorsey. That was his...
Jerry Dorsey, and that came from John Pertwee, Doctor Who.
Doctor Who?
Anyway, that was Engelbert.
I remember when I used to play with Colin Joy, we'd start off with an up-tempo number, and the second number we always did was There Goes My Everything, which I think Engelbert had as a hit at the time. That was in the 70s sometime. So we'd always do Colin, again, we'd go all soft and moody and we'd play There Goes My Everything on the road. But go on.
The interesting thing was he used to have a club in England, and that's how he, you know, got to. And I, when I was young, had a little club, and the resident band was three of us, and I was the drummer, and I wasn't a Jerry Baker, but the two boys I played with were fantastic, and so that's how we got talking about music, because we used to do the Yardbirds and Dave Clark Five and all that crap.
Yeah.
But it was good mulling it over with someone who he was a good piano player, Pertwee, evidently. I didn't know that. But anyway, that's how we sort of got on very well. We had a good 14 days on Turtle Island.
Look, you should look him up. I don't know when he's here, but I know he's here, and just say, look, Eng, it's Jonathan here. And he'll remember you, mate, the man of two guys.
Oh, he will. He will, because we had a really good time. As soon as Titch broke the ice with, you know, please release me, get me out of here, we're on.
Great to talk to you, Jonathan. You've got the F1 on there today. Do you go to that, or what's the story?
I don't have to go to it, Macca. I can listen to it.
It's amazing. I was just thinking about the crowd that goes. They're completely different people, aren't they? They go to the F1. It's sort of a glamour, models, all that sort of stuff. It's high end, the F1, isn't it? Because there's a lot of money involved, I suppose.
Well, it is. It's a bit of a social thing, the whole thing. But as I said, I can sit on the balcony and I can imagine it with the noise.
G'day, this is Macca.
Hi, Macca. It's Chris Reeks in Cooma.
Yes, Chris.
In 2 weeks' time, on the 21st of March, we're remembering the loss of the Southern Cloud airliner, which disappeared over the Snowy Mountains in 1931.
How many people were killed on that?
There were 8 people killed. There was the 2 pilots and 6 crew. And yeah. It was the first major air crash in Australia.
1931. When did you say this is? In a week's time, or?
In 2 weeks' time, on the 21st of March, the same day that it actually disappeared in 1931.
And is there a plaque or something there in Cooma, is there?
We have a memorial with parts of the wrecked aircraft, and we're having a memorial service over there where the fellow who found the wreckage in 1958, Tom Saunter, will be there.
So, go on.
Sorry. You're right. Were we there? He found the wreckage in October 1958, 27 years after it disappeared.
Wow. Great story. And, I think I've read about the Southern Cloud story. But
it's a bit of a mystery, yeah.
Yeah, and that was, yeah, they didn't find it for years later, did they? What's that, 27 years?
27 years, yes, that's correct.
All right, Chris, how's things in Cooma quickly?
Oh, a bit cool, overcast. Other than that, it's all right. It's only going to be 19 today, I think.
Good on you, Chrissy. Nice to talk to you.
Okay. Thanks, mate.
Bye. This is the All Over News. And people in Oz are talking about, well, they're talking about the Group 1. Those people are obsessed by the Group 1. They're talking about inflation, the monsoon, all sorts of things. We'll start off with inflation. And last week on the program, our colleague Georgina Topp returned from the Winter Olympics in Italy. This is what she had to say. And what stood out to you when you went from good old Australia with the cost of living through the roof when you lobbed in Italy in Bormio?
It was actually a lot cheaper to eat in Italy. You know, just going out for breakfast, you could get a croissant and coffee, yeah, for $6. I'm going to say everything was about 30% cheaper than Australian prices for food. And also, the food quality is excellent. Like, the Italians love food and they eat really well. They just wouldn't put up with a bad meal, you know, so all the food is just wonderful.
I've tried to work out what life's all about, but one thing I know it's about is to eat well. Nice food is the thing of life, and the Italians obviously, and the French seem to know that too. And food's expensive here in Australia.
It's going up.
And yeah. I'm just amused and bemused about the cost of living and the cost of food because that affects everybody.
I was eating out all the time, I guess, because I didn't have anywhere to cook. Yeah, the cost of food was definitely cheaper and just so much better. And people really care about the food. Like, you know, you go into patisserie and people are making everything on site, just really delicious and varied food.
It's just anecdotal, but a report from Italy. Don Radford says, for some time I've been cogitating about a topic that you and your listeners have dealt with frequently, namely the apparent disparity between the published inflation data and our lived daily experience. As this is speculation at present, I suggest that we need to quantify it by means of a second inflation index in parallel with the official one, an everyday inflation index, which would have just three weighted components, namely food, petrol, and electricity. Another possible candidate for inclusion is insurance. These three or four items are those in which we experience sensitively any price rises and are more related to our everyday expenditure than most of the items in the official basket. An economist would have the data to reconstruct this index for, say, the past 10 years and post it beside the official values. Maybe a project for your economist, Lee Harkness, to tackle, and perhaps get a publication out of it. This would either confirm quantitatively what we believe or refute it, says Don Radford. A very good idea, Don. But again, you would think that that would be something that Treasury or someone in government, some department in government, will be doing alongside the official version. It's a bit like the weather. It's the impression we get about the cost of living. This is the All Over News, and our reporters are doing all sorts of things when they ring us. This was Dr. John last week.
I'm in the middle of the Peak to Park Run, which is a 10-kilometre fitness run. This is the 20th year. It goes from Picnic Point to Lake Annan, and there's 5,000 Toomborites here. Not bad out of 100,000.
Are you running or jogging or shuffling?
Yeah, I'm jogging. My sprint, they call it jog, so my jog is probably a shuffle, mate. Just finishing, about your age, so I'm just finishing my career with a PhD. I'm looking at the rights of young women dying of breast cancer and driving a car. We know that the mortality rate and the road are going up, and the incidence of opioids in the autopsies has increased. We know there's an issue with people using these drugs. What got me was a number of young women came and said, you know, we want to stay involved in life. We've got two little kids or something. Can I do the school pickup? I'm taking these drugs. And nobody could tell them. I'm supposed to be an expert in the field. So in the end, I sort of drew up a bit of a plan. I said, well, when we go to court, I might be able to get you off. But these people are responsible, but nobody's talking to them about what to do, how to judge whether they should drive or not. So I did a research. I interviewed their doctors, then their pharmacists, and then followed a group of 10 dying women for a year. Two of them died in that year. But they're all driving and being very responsible, but only on their own deaths or what's happening. Nobody says anything to them. That has to change, I think. And you can imagine, in our society, we say, oh, you're dying, you're 50, you're dying, you're in palliative care, and we promise you to live your life to the fullest, but we're going to take your license off you and knock back your freedom and independence. You should be careful about doing that sort of thing.
John, now you've done your PhD in what's it called?
Well, it's the views and practices, perceptions and attitudes of breast cancer women with advanced cancer to driving and how they make decisions and who influences those decisions. That's the doctors and pharmacists. Yes, I'm an old bush doctor and an old man and specialised in palliative care. Did another three years of training when I was 52.
You saw this in your practice, of course, and you thought...
Oh, yeah. People show up, on a heap of opioids, which we know cognitively impairs you, and they'd say, oh, by the way, doc, no one's told me where they can drive on this. They've driven to see me. What are my rights? And there's a huge hole there. But I think the general public have got to have a say in this sort of thing.
Yes.
It's about community rights and community safety. If you've got any mates in the system, like the guy who did the story on the broken neck bull rider or anything, just put a word in for me, will you, mate?
I'm always amazed by the people who ring us in the morning. That's Dr. John Gillette. And I had this from Hannah Troy. She says, modern opiates, the sustained-release proprietary drugs, are a different kettle of fish to the old, non-patentable, simple opiates. Why not remove the licenses for all people on high-dosed antidepressants and many other psych medications? The shelves would be empty if they removed from sale all of the drugs that come with a warning not to use if driving, says Hannah. And we were also talking about older drivers last week. And Hannah says, Macca, the people who have the stats on older versus younger drivers are the insurance companies. Car insurance is cheaper for older people, and that says it all. This is the All Over News. I think it's important to find out news, bits and pieces that are happening all around Australia. We often don't get a lot of news of Tasmania. Malcolm rang last week.
Yeah. Hello, Macca. Malcolm here from La Trobe in Tasmania.
Hi, Malcolm.
Macca, you were talking about inflation and we have to stop spending back before 9. What I was just going to say is with inflation first and these data centres and AI, you wait a few months. There's thousands of people being put out of work in Australia as we speak because of AI. Where's all the money going to come from for people to spend and create inflation? There's a question for you to look into a bit more, but we're going to have a major social and economic disaster here in Australia with AI and data centres shortly. But, Macca, I'm driving to Burnie to a rally against Mariners Link. Mariners Link is a $5 billion power cable being proposed to be built from Tasmania to Victoria. It is, in my 63 years in Tasmania, it is the worst economic and environmental decision that's been made in my lifetime. It is just the biggest scam, Macca. And Tasmania is paying 17.5% of that Mariners Link. Tasmania is in a financial mess, and its own Treasury Department last week, Macca, said that if Tasmanian government continues on its trajectory, by 2040, we will be $146 billion in debt, and we will have to spend 50% of our revenue just servicing that debt. We've already got stretched hospitals, stretched schools. Our roads are in a mess. Macca, it is disaster. We had Electric Eric with our premier back in the 50s
Electric
and 60s.
Eric, yeah.
And he built all the hydro dams for cheap power for Tasmanians and to attract industry here. Eric Reese would be rolling in his grave, Macca, if he knew what this government was doing today, trying to flog all our power off to the mainland. If we listen to Bruce Mountain, energy economist from Victoria, he's saying this is madness, absolute madness.
All right, Mal, good
right,
on you.
Macca. Thanks, mate. Bye.
See you, bye. And I'd never heard of Mariners Link, and you probably hadn't either, but that's what's proposed anyway for Tasmania to Victoria. To the monsoon, and our correspondent Nicholas Orton says, in his tale Chasing the Monsoon, Alexander Frater charts the impact of the monsoon on people's lives in India as it brings life-giving rain to the subcontinent. He writes, during anxious days waiting for the monsoon to arrive in southern India, the weather forecaster is king. A joyful period of anticipation ensues, a time of expectation, promiscuity and scandal. In Darwin, Australia, October and November are uncomfortable months. There is tension in the air, not sure about the promiscuity, as residents await for the arrival of the relatively cooling monsoon or wet. As the first rains fall and the searing heat lifts, the land turns green and the air transmits the scent of tropical storms. The influx of damp air and heavy rainfall generated usually occurs in periodic bursts, active and non-active phases, between November and April each year. There are about 2 to 4 active phases each wet season. According to the Bureau of Meteorology, the historical average monsoon onset date is the 28th of December. Last year, the monsoon was very late, not arriving in Darwin until the 7th of February. It is thought that the monsoon is partly manipulated by the Madden-Julian Oscillation, that's the MJO, a large-scale, slow-moving band of increased cloudiness that travels eastward. Before the rain begins and the clouds roll in, one of the first odours you notice is the sweet, pungent zing of ozone. When the rains arrive, other odours come to life as raindrops disturb and displace odoriferous molecules on surfaces, particularly dry ones. The scientific name for this scent is petrichor, a title first conferred by two Australian researchers in the 1960s. Nicholas Orton continues, the February bellwether. In olden days, a bell was attached to a lead sheep or wether so that a shepherd could locate his flock. For some time now, I've been writing about a harsh drought that could take place in southeastern Australia by approximately 2031 to 33. This prediction is based on periodic peaks in the mean February temperatures recorded at my place. This is hardly rigorous or peer-reviewed science. Rather, the musings of an amateur weather enthusiast looking for rhythms and patterns in the local weather and extrapolating his observations into the wider sphere. The butterfly effect, if you will. Nicholas reminds us of the publicity poster for Peter Weir's film The Last Wave, which went like this. Hasn't the weather been strange? Could it be a warning? The Last Wave from 1977. It's fascinating, he says, finally, to realise that some of the monsoon rain falling on northern Australia's Kimberleys makes its way underground thousands of kilometres south to emerge at South Australia's Nullarbor Cliffs and into the Great Southern Ocean. During this water's journey, it sustains life in the desiccated regions of Central Australia. Not to forget either, I suppose, that some of that water will end up in the Great Artesian Basin. Thank you, Nicholas. And quickly, a word on petrol and particularly diesel prices. I remember talking to some travellers last year who said they'd spent thousands travelling on diesel. They were in Darwin at the time and they were going somewhere else, and they bemoaned the fact that the cost of diesel was very expensive. So if prices continue to rise or the war continues, you may find that there's not nearly as many travellers heading north as they usually do post Anzac Day. On the line is ABC announcer in Darwin, Drive Show, Adam Steer. Good morning, Adam.
Morning, Macca.
I've been trying to get on to people up there this morning, but everybody's asleep because you're an hour and a half behind us, and I suppose you've had a busy time. Tell us about the rain, mate.
Oh, yeah. So it feels like it's been raining here in biblical proportions. 40 days and 40 nights, at least, it's been raining.
Wow.
Over the last sort of 48 hours, particularly at the bottom of the top end, there has been these major flooding events because some areas are getting up to 250 mils of water in just 24 hours. So even for the wet season and even for the top end, that is sometimes the monthly total or maybe even half-yearly total for some of those areas. So it's an extraordinary amount of water that's come out of the sky. And then Catherine and I have been trying to get to our reporter and Catherine James Elton, who's been doing an absolutely magnificent job there. If people can remember what it's like to drive past or over the bridge at Catherine, you will see there's a rail bridge next to the road, and they would be a skyscraper space in the dry season between the bottom of the river and the top of the bridge. That is not there at the moment, but 19.15 mils of water was at that bridge last night, lapping up pretty similar to the levels of the 2006 floods in the area.
Yeah, and I know I read about the Daly River. We were there, you know, 20 years ago on the Daly River, and a lovely place, lots of crocodiles there. But these floods, it'll mean the crocs will go swimming and just going searching for new adventures, won't they? And you'll never know where they'll turn up.
Certainly, they could be anywhere. There, you know, particularly on the Adelaide River, there is a lot of crocodiles. A lot of crocodiles there. We've seen some images of even large freshwater crocodiles skipping across the roads at some speed. That's the concern of the saltwater crocodiles popping up in people's backyards. I was talking to a lady yesterday in a remote community called Palumpa, which is outside of Katherine, and they'd already spied crocodiles, lots of snakes, obviously, in the water. That community got fixed-wing lifted, evacuated about 200 people out of the community. But the poor old folk at Daly River, so this is a different system that's further down from the Katherine River system. Yesterday, authorities came in there, and these folk had just been in Darwin in an evacuation centre for the last fortnight because of the flooding that had happened. They got sent home. A week later, the flooding has happened quite quickly again. So the government employed 13 helicopters to evacuate more than 300 people out of the community. It'd be something like a scene out of Flight of Lord of the Valkyries or something, Macca.
Exactly. And I know that somebody told me the monsoon started last year sometime in February, but this year it started in December. And I know there's wet and dry, there's wet and dry wets or drier wets, but this one looks like it's going to be a record.
Yeah, so we had that cyclone Fina right at the beginning of the cyclone season, which is very unusual. You'd usually get the cyclones around this time of the year. So there was a lot of water dumped into the system at the beginning of the year, and then it feels like it's been just raining since then, which I would have to say has been absolutely beautiful for most of it, because it keeps, you know, some of the moisture, well, not the moisture, it keeps the humidity out a little bit. It just makes everything a little cooler. The top end is beautiful and green at the moment, except if there's too much water. And for a lot of those residents in Katherine, they had a significant rain for the floods in 1998. There was significant rain for the floods in 2006, and now this again. So whilst I can say it looks beautiful for a lot of people, it's been really triggering because people have obviously lost houses. And as you allude to, you don't want to have a giant snappy handbag in your backyard, do you?
The leather undertakers, no. So Mataranka, they'll be on alert too there, and I suspect, what's the forecast? Is this going to continue for another week or so? Or
there's a tropical, there's what we call the Madden-Julian Oscillation, which is this weather event which goes around the equator, and that usually brings the major weather events with it. And so that is slowly moving away from us at the moment. There are some tropical lows that are still down at the bottom of the top end. So the Weather Bureau said to me yesterday that the weather should start to ease off in the next couple of days. Fingers crossed. But as the emergency services have said, you never know, it's the weather. I mean, because the flooding event yesterday really took emergency services by surprise the day before, because, you know, it's such a large amount of water that's moving down a weather system. It only takes maybe a small amount of rain to come to turn that from just being a minor flood to a major flood level.
Yeah. Adam Steer, thanks for talking to us this morning. Sorry to wake you up.
Before we go, Macca, the other big thing is the roads. Mm. So the Stuart Highway, which is that main connection from Darwin to the bottom of South Australia, that's been cut off in Katherine. And so the freight and goods that are being supplied to Katherine and then the larger cities of Palmerston and Darwin, they're like the supermarket shelves are pretty vacant at the moment. Nobody's making a guacamole tomorrow, Macca, because they haven't seen an avocado in days.
Well, there you go. So there'll be trucks lined up there on the Stuart Highway somewhere. Whereabouts is that? Is it before you get into Katherine?
Pine Creek is one of the areas, and then just around Katherine itself. They put a levee in yesterday to try and stop flooding affecting the CBD. That levee was overwhelmed by water at some stage, but it was also a big like metal fence that went across Stuart Highway, so the Stuart Highway was blocked off man-made as well. But there's flooding on both sides of Katherine on the Stuart Highway.
All right, Adam Steer, good on you, mate. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye. G'day, this is Macca. Hello.
Macca, it's Anna. Is it me?
Hi, Anna. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So I just wanted to call to welcome
Scott, I could feel the, I suppose, the quiet excitement in his voice, but also the worry. I travel with Emirates a lot because they're a reliable airline, and I know the airport very well. So, welcome back.
Anna, if you've just got up, Anna's referring to a call we just had before the All Over News. Scott Turner has been in Dubai doing working there for a good while, but he just got on a plane, Emirates, and he said he was surprised that it was only a third full, I think, and others have said that. And he said while they were saying that bombing has stopped, he was there while debris was falling out of the sky. So and he sounded sort of pleased to be back home, didn't he, Anna?
Yeah, he did, yeah. I really, really enjoyed listening to him. And so welcome back. It's we're the best country in the world. And thank God they're so far away.
Exactly.
We feel very safe here.
Do you travel to Dubai, do you, Anna?
I don't travel to Dubai. I travel via Dubai to Europe because all my family are in Europe. So the last 10 years I've been traveling a lot. And the airport is huge. There's a lot of space. It's very spacious. The people are lovely, are friendly. I love the Arabs in their long gear. With the head things, I forget the name. My dream is to one day go to the desert, but to just be sort of dropped off in the middle of the desert, not see no one and just the sand and the sky. But that's probably not going to happen, especially with everything that's happening in the world.
No. It sounds like an amazing place. He was at Ras Al Khaimah. Is it Ras Al Khaimah, which is one of the northern states of the United Arab Emirates. And But when he tells me what they're building there, you know, 23,000 units and huge, you know, I mean, for us here in, you know, well, as Mr. Keating called us, the arse end of the world, and you feel like that when you hear what's happening around the place, don't you?
It's huge. Yeah, 3 years ago I decided to stay the night, and they asked me, you know, do you want to see Dubai? I go, no, thank you. I'll see the desert, but not today. So I just stayed because it is, I mean, it can be tiring. You know, it's a 14-hour flight, Melbourne-Dubai, and then 7 hours, usually either Portugal, Italy or Switzerland. So I decided to stay a night. It's really not expensive. It just depends on how people plan these trips. But,
amazing.
So, and I love your program. It's a happy program.
Mostly. Well, we try to keep it happy, but you've got to report on bits and pieces that are going on and people leaving bikes all over the city and e-bikes. And, I mean, I can't believe how we just let people who are riding e-bikes just do what they want to do. I mean, and who was I talking to this morning, Brendan was in Furano in Japan, and he was just saying what a lovely place it was. But he said, you know, there's every bike there has got a number plate. You've got to have a number plate and all those sort of things. But here it's anything goes, and nobody stands up and says, we're not going to put up with this. I mean, that's the job of a premier, isn't it, or a prime minister, but certainly a premier in a state. That's a job to say, well, look, this can't happen, and duddly-dum, and we're taking action to do this. But just drags on and on and on. There's dead bikes all over the place. But in Japan, it seems like it's very well ordered, and maybe Australians don't like to be ordered, if you know what I mean. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think in Melbourne, my best mate is an RN. She's a nurse, and when we talk about e-bikes, she just goes, brain injuries. And in Melbourne, they because I work in the CBD, there's a lot of the e-bikes on the footpath, and I just run a mile. I mean, I plan the footpath. I go, which one should I choose today? Because it's such speed. It's impossible of the body. You know, you don't have time to move.
No. And some poor person gets knocked down and they're doing 40 Ks on bike tracks. It's ridiculous.
Yes.
Anna, great to talk to you. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. It's a
pleasure. Bye. G'day, this is Macca.
Macca, it's Dick Smith here.
Oh, g'day, Dick. How are you?
Yeah, look, I wanted to call in because I heard Malcolm Ryan, the Tasmanian who was complaining about the Mariners link, and then you had him on again. You played it again this morning.
Yeah, and I'd never heard of the Mariners, and I suppose lots of Australians, because as I said at the time, we don't tend to hear news about the other state. We sort of do, but only if it's, you know, somebody's been attacked or whatever. You don't hear the Mariners link. Now, tell people what the Mariners link is.
What it is, it's an extra cable. There's already a cable that joins the mainland with Tasmania for putting power one way or the other. Mm. But the plan is to put another huge power, multi-billion dollar power cable. And what the government is saying, the federal government, they're saying that Tasmania is going to be the battery of the nation.
Mm.
Now, the problem with that is that it's just completely delusional, because in the millennium drought, which was 1996 to 2010, Tasmania got so low on hydro, they didn't have enough to pump back up, they didn't have enough to use, and in the end they had to ship diesel generators, which I think are still there, to Tasmania. So this so-called Mariners cable is only going to work if you've got enough energy stored in the dams in Tasmania. If we have another millennium drought, which we're likely to, the whole thing will be basically useless. The other thing which is most important is that they're going to put in huge wind farms in Tasmania. And I was talking to Bob Browner during the week. One of them's going to be up where the Great Lakes area is on that plateau. It's going to have 47 giant turbines. It's being built and owned by Korean Zinc, which is a huge processing company in Korea. And they've been allowed to kill 2,000 birds and bats a year, because these wind farms kill bats and birds, and you're not allowed to kill native birds yourself because many of them are endangered. They've actually, the federal government's given permission for the Korean Zinc to kill 2,000 birds a year, and they won't be fined at all, which is just amazing.
I had a call this morning from Dave in Hobart. And he was telling me, he's just giving me a weather report, basically. And he said, Mackie, you're talking about, you know, rain in Katherine and rain in Queensland, and there's, you know, the monsoon continues and all that sort of stuff. We just talked about it. But he said, down here in Hobart, because he said, down here in Hobart, he said, we're in a drought. He said, it's probably the driest year we've had for a long while. But and I've always noticed, doing the program for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, that routinely when we go to Hobart, you go through the middle, oh, look, it's a big drought here, it's very dry, and I always thought of Tassie as wet, you know, basically, but it's not. It's not.
No, they have droughts. Now, this, one of the problems is they're going to obviously generate power with these huge wind farms. They've already destroyed the environment on the northwest coast, and they've got wind farms there, which is one of the windiest places you can get. I now notice on the northeast coast, last time I flew down there, they've got huge wind farms. And so Pip and I, we'd go to Tasmania once every couple of years and do a drive around it, because it's such the most beautiful natural place that it's just magnificent. But it's going to be covered in wind farms. It's a tiny state to have huge wind farms. And the batteries, let me just quickly explain to you the batteries. We've got a few big batteries, one in Adelaide and one's being built in Canberra. I did a check. The batteries, the companies buy the electricity at 39 kilowatt hours when the sun's out. Then they sell it back to the electrical network within a couple of hours when the sun goes down for wait for it, $263 a kilowatt hour. That's a 670% markup. Now, one of the reasons it's such a colossal markup is that they're making a mozza profit out of it. They're mainly foreign companies. Mm-hmm. But the other reason, the other reason is that the batteries are incredibly expensive.
Mm.
And so we've got Canberra's just, the ACT are building a new battery. It's costing $400 million. But what they don't mention, it will only run the ACT for 40 minutes. And we could need power for 3 days of batteries when you have a cloud over, say, Sydney for 3 days. We've had that. And you've got a wind drought, which happens at the same time. So it's all delusional. And I just can't believe we should be going down this track and destroying the environment as we do it.
Good on you, Dick. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You there, Tomo?
Yeah, Mac. How you doing?
I'm all right, mate. What's happening?
Yesterday, I had to go into Dorigo. I'm at Ebor. I had to go into Dorigo to put a couple of banners up for Right Pastor, who was sponsoring the dog trials. And watched the dog trials for an hour and a half, 2 hours or something. And it was just amazing what these dogs do, because they put three cattle into the thingo, and some of the owners whistle, some use hand signals, some use, speak to them sort of thing. And the dogs, some of them are a bit snappy at the cattle, and they get, I don't know really how it works, but they get points for putting the cattle through, the dogs putting the cattle through a couple of gates and, yeah, just doing different things. And, yeah, red kelpies and border collies and all that. And, yeah, it was just so interesting to watch, and the dogs are so smart.
They are amazing things, aren't they, Tomo? They're amazing things. Now, I was talking to a friend of mine, Jan, and she sometimes breeds kelpies for sale. But she said, yep, she went to a dog sale the other day, and I think they were selling kelpies for about $29,000, $30,000. And some of these dogs will go overseas and work with in Lapland or wherever with reindeer and all sorts of things, because they're wonderful. And $30,000, you think, well, that's a lot of money. But see, they can replace a man or indeed a woman doing that sort of job for a third of the price. And they never stop working. So talk about AI replacing people, but dogs, you get a dog to round up things and they just do a marvellous job. And when they're trained properly, so you have a dog and the dog will just do, when you're working with cattle or sheep, whatever, and as I said, reindeer, and I assume buffaloes or whatever, you're rounding up. The dog is man's best friend, Tom.
Yeah, well, that's right. You know, I've watched my boss, Glenn, you know, we've tried to round up cattle in a buggy sort of thing. And if they want to go whichever way they want to go, it's hard to get them to go in the right direction, whereas the dog just pushes them and, yeah, it's just so good. You know, it's...
Well, it's a wonderful thing to watch too, Tomo.
Yeah, it was incredible, you know. And some of them, you know, and I dare say it's, you know, if you get grumpy cattle sort of thing and they don't want to do it, it's a bit harder for the dog. But, yeah, there were a couple of the owners, and I think the collies were the best. And, yeah, one of them did it really quickly. And, yeah, I don't know the outcome of it. It's still on today, I think, at Dorigo. It's just very, very interesting.
Now, Tomo, weather report for Ebor. I know autumn has officially sort of started, but... and Ebor, if you're going to have autumn, you'll have it in Ebor, because it can be quite cool there. Have you felt any tinges of autumn, or is it rain or humidity, or what's the story?
Well, it has been quite warm and we haven't had much rain. You know, I think there was 79 mil last month. I've only had a couple of mil this month so far, but we might get... I looked at the radar earlier and there's a blob coming across towards Armidale, so we might get something today. But... last August was when we had that snow. I was hosing out the yard and I looked out and I thought, that's not rain, that's snow. And it snowed for about 5.5 hours. It was unbelievable.
Isn't that a lovely thing to see? A lovely thing to see.
One of my childhood dreams was to build a snowman, and I've got to do that.
Well, that's another one on your so-called bucket list, mate.
Yeah, 64 and I was building a snowman.
All right.
But yeah, I love it out here. It's the coast has just gone mental. It's just, you know, it's just too crowded. You know, up around the border there, Tweed Ed, Kingscliff, and that, between Kingscliff and Cabarita, it used to be all bush, and now it's all houses. And yeah, the roads haven't changed in 60 years, and people have got to get in their car and go somewhere. It's just that congested, and when it comes to school holidays and that, it's just mental.
But nobody says, it's the same in the big cities, mate. The roads haven't changed, but we're squeezed. Look, I don't know what the population is increase every year. When I was a kid, it was 90,000, maybe 100,000. But I think 500,000 to 600,000 a year has been arriving in Australia in the last 5 years. And you complain about the Northern Rivers and Southern Queensland, but Sydney and Melbourne are exactly the same, and the roads don't change, nothing changes, they just squeeze more and more people in. Yeah. It should be done in a measured way, that's what I think, but
I grew up in the same territory as you. I was born and bred in Cronulla, and during the 70s and 80s, it was a great place to live. But, yeah, I moved up the North Coast, I think, in 83. And there were four of us renting a house at Chindera for $40 a week. So it was 10 bucks each, and it was just unreal.
Good on you, Tomo. Thanks for the report.
Love your show, mate.
See you in Ebor.
See you, mate.
Bye. On the line is James Elton from Catherine. He's our journalist up there for the ABC. Good morning, James.
Hey, good morning.
We tried to ring you. We tried to ring everyone this morning, James, and we didn't have your number early on.
Oh dear!
So we had to ring. We had to ring someone else, and they gave me your number. And so here you are. Tell me, give me a look out the window in Catherine, mate.
Well, I'm standing out the front of my place right now in Catherine South, and we've got a substantial amount of water coming down the street, and it stops right at my house, at my driveway. So
I arranged that, actually, James. I arranged that.
Thanks for that. So I'm feeling, personally very grateful, but it's been, a really rough night for a lot of people in Catherine. The water started getting really high sort of yesterday afternoon. The river crossed over the 19-meter mark and has basically reached, depending on who you ask, possibly exceeded the 2006 major flood level for Catherine. So biggest flood in 20 years at least, possibly the biggest since 1998. And there's large, large parts of Catherine North and Catherine South with houses that have got water all around them and inundating their ground floors.
And I suppose, is Catherine Gorge, is that flood and all that sort of thing? Is that where the water's coming from or going to?
Totally. That's where it comes from. So basically the way it works is people start getting worried when they see when the gorge floods. Mm. So the gorge floods first, and then people have a little formula, which I have to say has turned out to be pretty true, which is that if you see what the river's doing at the gorge and plus 10 metres, usually that's what you get in town a short time later. So it's sort of like a lead indicator. So the good thing about that is that water has actually been dropping at the gorge this morning. So hopefully that means, a little bit later today, we start to see some relief. I think in the CBD, you can see the water already starting to recede slightly, very slowly. But in other places, it's a mixed picture. As all this water sort of works its way through the levee system and through different streams and so on.
As Dick Smith would probably say, if you haven't been to Catherine Gorge, he says it's about everywhere, but if you haven't been to Catherine Gorge, you're not a real Australian. I remember I went to, it was 1977, and I was a young reporter like you, and I went to, they had the Northern Australian Development Conference there, and everybody was there from Northern Australia, and we went and did a program. I was running around doing interviews with people like Bjelke Petersen, and Ida Buttrose was there, I think, too, as a young girl, a young woman. And I went for a swim in Catherine Gorge, but you wouldn't do that anymore because they said, oh, no, you can swim in Catherine Gorge because there's only freshies in there and they'll be fine. But I think the times have changed. James, would I be right?
Oh, well, yes and no. You certainly can't swim anywhere in the gorge in the wet season. But in the dry season, you can swim from gorge two and upwards. So
they've checked it for the leather undertakers, have they?
They do. They do crocodile management, and they check it all. And basically, the theory is that once the gorges sort of disconnect because of those rock bars in between each part of the gorge, you are all good. And I do frequently in the dry swim in. At Butterfly Gorge in number two, and it's beautiful. It's so good.
It is lovely. But I thought, because people say, look, because we have a correspondent in Arnhem Land somewhere, I forget where he, but he says, you don't swim in billabongs or anywhere because of floods, Andy Ralfrings, et cetera, from time to time. And he said, because of floods and stuff, and when the floods come, the salties take off and they find themselves in a freshwater billabong and they think, oh, this is good, I'll stay here. So you don't, they're called salt waters, but they're salt waters in name only.
Well, that's right. And actually, with all this flood water around, people have been seeing crocs in unexpected places.
In their bathroom or, yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, well, that's it. They're, I mean, some of my friends have been sending me pictures of very suspicious looking tails and things like that in the suburbs. So
suburbs. In the suburbs. James, how long have you been a reporter in Katherine?
I'm at about 2 and a bit years now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And where are you from originally?
From Sydney.
From like Sydney. Wow. Yeah. Well, this, what a great experience. What a great experience.
Yeah. Well, indeed. I've certainly learned a lot about floods.
And crocodiles, obviously, and gorges. Yeah. And buffaloes. Lots of buffaloes up in the territory still?
Yeah, absolutely there are. Probably the animal I have to break for the most on highways in Arnhem Land and heading out to communities. They don't fear you, you know. They'll just stand there.
But they're huge. I mean, they are huge. And the same thing's happening in the snowy mountains of New South Wales and probably the Alps with deer, reindeer, and they're big units too. And they'll just stand in the middle of the road, and you don't want to be driving one of those little Echos, you know, whatever they are, Toyota Echos or whatever they are, a little car like that, because you'll just finish off second best.
No, indeed. And speaking of cars finishing off second best, I think there's quite a few people have got their cars stuck driving through floodwaters. I was looking down the highway next to my street last night and saw a car looking very abandoned in the middle of the road with floodwater up around its windows. So, yeah, a lot of especially those smaller cars that haven't got the clearance have been having a hard time of it, I think. But, of course, the advice is, don't do it. Don't drive through.
No, you'd think people would learn. I mean, they just keep routinely, we say that, don't drive through floodwaters, but I don't know. James, great to talk to you. Thanks for your report.
Thanks very much.
And, look after yourself, and hopefully it starts to – I suppose the mango farms – there's still mango farms up around your place, isn't there?
There are, yes, there are. And it'll be interesting to see what the impact is. I know people with cattle have been having a bad 24 hours too, just trying to get all their cattle to higher places, but it's been a bit of a struggle. I'm not sure yet what the impact is on the horticulture side of things on the mango farms.
Good on you, James. Great to talk, mate.
Thanks very much.
See ya. Noel's in Bathurst. Morning, Noel.
Good morning, Macca.
How's things, mate?
Oh, chilly, 18 degrees, but it's fine, and it'll be good for the Bathurst Auto Fest. But I'm really here to talk about my epic historical movie posters display with the emphasis on heroes here at Bathurst at our beautiful live theatre. Can I tell you all about it?
You can. Just tell me about the Auto Fest. When's that on now?
Yeah, it's on now, last day today.
There's a lot of
street machines up here doing their thing. They're not racing around the track, but they're show and shine and go to woe.
When you say
that.
Street machines, like Ford GTs and Camaros and that sort of thing, older?
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure there's racing cars and sports cars as well. I saw a beautiful hotted up, E.K. Holden there, beautiful.
Oh, well, they're lovely. They're things of beauty because in those days, but yeah, they just had a bit of class, a bit of style, didn't they?
They
certainly did. And cars today all look the same. They all look like wheelie bins. Even when you see, you know, things that supposedly still have a bit of Italian style, like Ferraris and, you know, Porsches and stuff, they just look like, yes, they don't look. And I have an old Range Rover, which is a bit of a relic. But I bought it new in 1986, and I went up to get coffee this morning, and I parked the car, and because it was pouring rain, and I left the motor running, and these two young kids walked past. Well, they say young, they were 20, 25 or something, and they walked past, and they talking loudly, you know, it's 4:30 in the morning, 4:45, and they talked past, and they went, and then they stopped, and they looked at my car, and then he came back, and he said, "Is that your car, mate?" I said, "Yeah." Because you don't know at 5 a.m, you don't know what's going on. And he put his hand out and shook me. "Oh, mate, that's fabulous. It's a fabulous car." Because they just look nice, you know. So the Auto Fest's on. Now tell me about your posters.
Well, there'll be roughly 20 beautifully framed posters going back from 1938 with The Adventures of Robin Hood with Australian Errol Flynn through to Gladiator 2 in 2024. There are also other titles include Spartacus from 1960, El Cid, E-L-C-I-D, Charlton Heston, 1961, 55 Days at Peking, 1963,
wow.
Fall of the Roman Empire. A lot of these have Australian connections. Can I tell you who's who in the movies?
Tell me who's who in the movies.
Well, of course, Russell Crowe in Gladiator, but it also had the composer Lisa Gerrard worked with Hans Zimmer on the beautiful music score. Errol Flynn, of course. The Adventures of Robin Hood, 38. They Died with Their Boots On, 41. Sir Robert Helpman, star of ballet, stage and screen. He was in 55 Days at Peking. Frank Thring was also in Ben-Hur and El Cid.
Yes.
Director John Farrow was an Australian who worked exclusively in the US. He directed John Paul Jones. He's the father of Mia. And cinematographer Robert Krasker, a hugely in-demand cinematographer, did the wonderful work on Alexander the Great, El Cid, there's that name again, and the Fall of the Roman Empire. So there's plenty of Aussies involved.
Yeah. Now, Noel, tell me, what's your deal? Where did you get the posters?
Well, I'm a retiree. I'm 75. Mm. I've been collecting movie memorabilia since the age of 10, mainly souvenir movie programs. I have Australia's largest collection, is over 1,000, but I picked up a poster here, there, along the way, and I decided a few years ago to have them framed. They're all in my house. My house where I live is basically a museum full of movie memorabilia everywhere, and I happen to live there.
Now, where are these on display, these posters?
Our beautiful live theatre here in Bathurst called BMEC, Bathurst Memorial Entertainment Centre, William Street. This coming Tuesday, Wednesday, March 10, 11, between 10 and 4. But in the Wattle Foyer, people go in up the stairs. I can either turn right or left. And there you have it. I've spent the last week and a half getting them ready. They're all wrapped and beautifully ready to go. We put Spartacus in the van today. Took two people. That's how big it is.
I might try and get up there. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, did you say?
Just Tuesday, Wednesday, Macca.
Tuesday, Wednesday, okay.
From 10 to 4.
All right.
See you there.
Noel, nice to talk to you this morning, mate. Thank you.
Thanks, Macca.
See ya. Bye. Hey, this is Macca.
Hi, Macca. It's Richard Kerrison calling up in PNG. How are you?
G'day, Richard, in PNG. There you go. And what are you doing there?
I called in a couple of probably months ago. I'm up at the Hidden Valley Gold Mine. Obviously, we mine gold up here, up in the, it's called the Morobe Province.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually came back sort of late in my swing last week. What I want to just talk about, I've been down in Bombala, where I was born and raised. My cousin's 70th birthday party, which was just awesome to connect it back in with all the people back at home again. So it was a guy called Charlie Kimber. His family are synonymous with shearing, and his sister Barbara, is one of the top horse racing trainers in Australia. She actually appeared at the National Press Club this week with her and Gabe Wardhouse, where Barb told a great story. And Charlie's other brothers are all shearers. His brother Billy won the 83 Golden Shears back in the day. So it's just great to get home. Reconnect with my brother Philip. He's got a farm there. He got me doing some sheep work for a couple of days. I've actually come back to work for a rest, Macca. I didn't realise how hard sheep work was, actually.
That's why they get the dogs to do all the work, Richard.
Well, mate, I've got to tell you. So, I mean, my parents, we had dogs. They couldn't work, so it was the kids that were doing the work. So to watch my brother actually have some dogs that can work, and we had yards that actually function, I couldn't believe it. So it was actually so great to get home and, you know, touch the dirt and kick the rocks and all those things and see some great friends. There was a really great set of friends. We've got Ethel and Doreen Dent. Radish, she's a bit of a story there. He actually resuscitated my old man on the bowling green back in about 98. So we've just been great family friends for years. And it was just really great to get home and see everyone, mate. And unfortunately, you've got to come back to work and go and pay for that trip. It's just so good to get home and see all the crew and, you know, come back to work and get into it up here.
How long have you been in PNG for, Richard?
Probably about 18 months now. Yeah, the mine's been going since the early 2000s. We took it over in 2014.
And gold's gone through the roof, of course, hasn't it?
Oh, mate, it's just ticked over $5,000 an ounce at the moment. And look, the conflict in the Middle East is obviously not helpful for the people over there, but it's really shot the gold price up. So, we're doing everything we can to, you know, to get as much gold out the gate as we can. And it's I think I said this before, it's just such a great place to be. And, we're busy, and it's all hands on deck, mate.
Yeah, and what altitude are you at?
So we're about, at the highest part of the mine, we're about 2,800 metres above sea level. So the air does get a bit thin up here. It's been surprising. We've had some really cold weather the last probably week or so, and some high winds. The rainfall we've had, you know, since January, we're up around the 500 mil mark from January up until March, but we've had some really strong winds, and it has been quite chilly, actually. Once you get back into Bilolo and into Port Moresby, it's a lot, it's a lot more humid. But up here, it's definitely raincoat weather at the moment.
Yeah, because the monsoons here in Australia, certainly northern New South Wales, and I know sometimes you don't get your monsoon, you don't get the wet season like you normally do in PNG. But I would have thought maybe you're getting the rain that northern Australia's getting.
I think you're right. I mean, I think Australia as a whole, in some of the areas, has been getting hit pretty heavy with rain. We sort of see it more as a common thing up here. We don't have a distinct, you know, cyclone or a monsoon season. We just get it's a straight line, probably 3.5 metres of rain a year. And you just learn to adapt and sort of get on with it, Macca. I mean, our road network here is pretty good. The operators here are very good at what they do. They can handle the conditions quite well. And because we're so high up, the water runs off, so it doesn't sort of stay laying around for too long. But it's certainly very wet up here, I can assure you.
All right, Richard, nice to welcome you back to Australia while you were there, but in PNG. And whereabouts exactly are you?
It's called the Hidden Valley Gold Mine, mate. It's up past a little place called Bilolo. We're in the Morobe province, so we're a 45-minute flight out of Port Moresby, and then we're about an hour and a half up the hill in a bus. You get a beautiful view on a clear day. You can see into Wow, and actually it was where John Laws was born. And we're not far from the Bulldog Track, which links into Kokoda. So, you know, we're quite, I guess it's quite synonymous with the, you know, the war effort, and there's just such that great relationship between the PNG people and the Australians. It's a pretty cool place to work, Macca, I've got to tell you.
Good on you, Richard. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, mate. Take care. See ya.
Bye. In my studio this morning, I have a lady called, and I'll apologise if I get it wrong, Lydia Zabunya. Is that right, Lydia? Good morning.
Lida, just L-I-D-A.
Lida. Yeah. Lida. Now, I've talked to Lida a couple of times in the last couple of years. Lida, amongst other things, is a motorbike rider. Is that right, Lida?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you were on the road somewhere out in...
Uindamoo. We went to Uindamoo last year, and I rang you up a couple of times. Yeah.
And you're a motorbike rider. What do you ride?
BMW GS650.
Wow, that's a nice bike. Now you're going to go on the road, and tell me what you're about to do.
On the 1st of June, we're going to be leaving Uluru, doing a ride through Warburton and ending at Laverton, and it should take roughly around a week. I'll be riding off-road, but if I'm unwell, I've also got a four-wheel drive ute following me with a four-wheel drive trailer. So I'm hoping that I'll find another 8 riders to come along with me as well. So I do have space for like 3 bikes in the event that someone breaks down. And I also want to have a space on the trailer in the event that I don't feel well and I need to put the bike on the back of the truck and go in the truck.
Lida sent me an email and says, amongst other things, I was diagnosed with gastric cancer in 23, had a major surgery followed up 6 months aggressive chemotherapy. My oncologist told me I had a 45% chance of survival. But these odds were based on old European research. My surgeon constantly complained to me about the lack of funding for research into gastric cancer. And that's why you're doing your ride. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
So why are you starting at Uluru? So you're riding to Uluru and then starting your ride across...
Because I want to do a dirt... I always wanted to do Dolly's Ride, which was 12 women going across the Simpson Desert, but I never felt like I was fit or strong enough to do that because it's mainly through sand. So I wanted to do this ride because my friend Betty Wilcox, who's a renal nurse, I saw her in Yuendamu and now she's got a contract in Warburton. Mm. So I want to see her in Warburton, but I thought that I'd just then create a dirt ride that was a little bit easier than the Simpson Desert.
a lot easier.
Yeah, over the course of a week and then support the ride.
So I think isn't there plans to bituminise that road out to Warburton?
I don't know either.
I spoke to somebody some time ago last year about that anyway. So you're limiting your ride to 8 riders, right? But if people want to join you, what do they do?
Just contact me via email to litter1@iinet.net.au or they can ring me up on my mobile.
iinet.net.au. There you go. All right. And you've been riding bikes all your life, have you?
No. My husband and I started off on bicycles, and when we rang you up from Ilfracombe, we were doing a lap around Australia, and we spent a few years travelling across the States and in Europe. And then when we got home, we had a child, and he changed our lives. And he's the one actually who got us into motorcycling. He got into off-road motorcycling, and then I bought my husband a motorbike. And then I eventually got a motorbike too because I thought, well, if they're riding, I might as well too. And now my husband and I are motorcycle touring and my son's given up.
And what do you like about the cycling and the motorcycling touring? And
I really enjoyed bicycling. I just loved being out in the open and, I don't know, just seeing the country via a bicycle. I mean, a lot of people say how boring it is going across the Nullarbor, but it's not boring at all, and it's a lovely slow pace and it's really enjoyable. I find the motorcycle a bit more terrifying than the bicycle because because you're going at such a fast speed, and it just seems a bit more precarious. But I love being out on the open road with no vehicles, really. Yeah.
But there'd be a lot of trucks on the Nullarbor, of course.
But they're only there occasionally, and you're aware of when they're coming, and you pull over. Like on the bicycles, we used to always pull over and let them pass. And so, there are some, but they don't. It's not like going on the M4 or
no. Or the freeway. Well, you can't ride a bicycle on the freeways, can you, really? You're not supposed to.
So no.
You stick to the highways. Speaking of trucks, they're probably all jacked up on the Stuart Highway, Kel, just out of Katherine, because the road up there is cut because there's been lots and lots of rain up in the Territory and in Queensland and around the place. Not so much in Hobart, but around the place there's been lots of rain and lots of weather, the monsoon and things like that. So, well, good luck, Lida.
Thank you.
It's a lovely thing to do. Out on the Nullarbor, it's not really the Nullarbor, that road. The Nullarbor starts sort of where the train line is, I think, and goes a bit further north. But near enough is good enough. And it's an amazing place to be, isn't it? An amazing place to be in Australia.
Yes, and we've never done that road at all, so I'm looking. But this is the first time I'm going without my husband, so he's staying home to look after our two rescue dogs. So, but I've got a support team behind me who'll be travelling with me.
Can I ask how old you are, Lida?
I'll be 67 on March 18.
And how's your health going?
It's okay. I'm currently getting treatment, so I'm hoping I'll be okay to go on the ride. Mm. I mainly I sort of mainly did it to sort of just keep me in a positive headspace.
Exactly.
Really. And my friend said, like, if I died before I did the ride, then they would do the ride without me to raise the funds for gastric cancer too. So.
Well, you're a little champion. You can sit there for a while if you like, but it's nice to see you. I remember your calls from out there out in the great outdoors. But, yeah, good luck. What's the contact again? It's...
Do you want my mobile or just my email?
Whatever, give them your mobile.
So my mobile is 0493 227 187.
187. Well, turn it off now because they'll start ringing while you're 0493 227 187. Now, do you want women to go with you on your ride, or men?
It can anything? Be men or women. It doesn't really matter.
Okay.
No.
And to support you, and for gastric cancer research, because there's very little, because all the diseases, everybody, you know, they're all clamoring for money, you know, and you can see the breast cancer, and everybody's, you know, after money for, you know, and I suppose there's only so much money to go around, so yeah, you've got to, the squeaky goat gets the oil, as they say.
Yep.
Lida, nice to talk to you, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
G'day.
Hello, Ian?
Yeah.
Hey, how are you, mate? Lindsay Mutimer from Herbert out the other side of Humpty Doo, mate. How are you going?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, I just thought I'd give you a quick buzz and let you know what the conditions were down the Stuart Highway. I went down a couple of weeks ago to go to the Grand Prix. I was invited to go down by a cousin of mine, Phil Aiken, who's racing an old 1956 Vauxhall, which was built for the Grand Prix them days, and owned by a mate of his, George, and I was invited down for this, and got down there, mate, and on the Sunday, last Sunday, I was watching the weather up here, and my wife's home on her own here, and we had three or four lows around, and I thought, I was getting a bit anxious, and I thought, not real good me being away, 3,500 k's away when she's on her own, and if you get a low, can develop into a cyclone pretty quick. So I bit the bullet and I apologised and I said, look, I'm going to have to make a move. So I took off from Melton down near Melbourne on the Monday morning and drove to Morgan in South Australia, camped overnight, and then I got going the next morning early and got up through... Port Augusta, and then I thought I was making pretty good time. Then I got up to Glendambo, and there was about 20 or 30 road trains all stacked up around the Glendambo roadhouse, and I thought, this is not good. So anyway, I pulled up and had a bit of a yarn to a couple of blokes, and they said, the road between Glendambo and Cooper Pedy, there's a bridge there, and the bridge, they're not happy with the bridge with all the water that's gone underneath it, with all the foundations of the bridge. So they said, it could be out for up to a week. Oh, I thought, you're joking. So anyway, I poked down the road further and got to the road closure sign where you weren't allowed to go any further. And I thought, well, all I can do is, I rang my wife, I still had phone reception in a couple of spots, and I said, is there anywhere I can go to get around this? And she said, no. She had a look on the computer and she said, no, all the roads are closed, even going right back to, go back to Port Augusta and go across the top of towards Hay that way. All the roads going north there were all out too. So I thought, well, I'll just wait it out. So I set up a bit of a camp in the bush on a bit of high ground.
As you do, yeah.
Yeah, well, I was expecting to stay there for a few days. I had Tucker and that with me. And anyway, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, this might have been about lunchtime, I pulled up. And then I started hearing trucks moving, and I sort of drove out on the road. And there was trucks going both ways. And I thought, well, something's going on. They may have made a detour or something. So I drove down to where the road closure sign was, right across the road, and they had blokes there and couldn't go any further. And that was all gone. So I thought, well, this is fantastic. I'm going to get home. So I got going and got to where the bridge was. And, of course, there, what's happened was the bloody bridge had been washed out underneath, and the foundations of the uprights holding the bridge up on one side weren't even in the ground. So they had engineers there and assessing it all since Sunday when all this happened. So it was only a fluke that I got there when they decided they were going to let road trains and things go across the bridge on a particular angle so that, the stress of the 100-ton road trains weren't going to destroy the bridge or do any more damage. So there was only one lane going across, and you had to go across slow, and they were all there watching and that. So
should be on TV. See, that should be on TV. That's a great story. If television had that story on, I mean, it'd be compulsive viewing, mate. But, out there in the great wide Australia, that's where the action is, mate. We live lives of quiet desperation in the suburbs, but that sounds a mighty place. So you're where on the Herbert now, are you, or near the Herbert?
No, I live out the other side of Humpty Doo. I'm Herbert. I got home. I got to Catherine. I kept going and got to the old Dunder turn off that night about midnight, and then I camped. And then next morning, signs up all over the road going to Alice. You know, water over the road, water over the road. So I got to Alice in the daylight about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning, and the Todd Rivers ride up again. Not to the left hand side of the road, but all that low country on the right hand side was all underwater again. So I got going. And then got up to. I just kept going and got to Catherine about 7 o'clock that night, and the bridge was about 13 or 14 metres, and I thought, oh, that's not too bad, you know. And
now it's about 19, I think, isn't it? About 19 now.
On the Wednesday it was about 13 or 14, got home that night about 10 o'clock back here, and then next morning it was up to 16 or 17, and then now it's back into town again where it was about 2006. So, no, I was lucky to get home, mate. I just dodged the bullet all the way. So, yeah.
It's a lovely story, Lindsay, which should have been all filmed. I'd love to see that bridge and the trucks, and it's great out there. You're great out there, especially when there's something like that. And I remember when the Nullarbor, that road across there, was flooded. This is 30 years ago, and lady rang up and she said, oh, look, my husband, I don't know where he is, but I think, and then he rang up and said, oh, we're stuck. It was great. It was a lovely story. And there was, you know, there's 30, 40, 50, 60 trucks on both sides of that. So it's a great country we live in, Linz.
Well, Ian, I've been travelling up and down the Stuart Highway since the early 70s, and I, once you get to, well, it's green all the way from Port Augusta, but once you get to Cooper Pedy north, the grass is about 2 to 3 foot high all the way, and normally you see kangaroos and cattle all over the road and all that sort of stuff, and you've got to slow down or whatever, but because there's so much grass everywhere and water,
they don't bother.
Never saw a thing, mate. Never saw a thing.
Good on you, Lindsay. Great to talk to you, mate.
Thanks, Ian. Bye, mate.
Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks for your call. G'day, this is Macca.
Oh, good morning.
Morning,
Macca. It's Malcolm.
G'day, Malcolm.
Malcolm from, I live in the community of Barunga in the Northern Territory. We're about 100 kilometres southeast of Catherine.
How are you travelling?
Well, we're okay. We don't get flooded in because we have a little creek that goes through our community, and it came up over the road the other day, but it doesn't stop us getting out to the highway. But the next community over at Beswick, they've been in lockdown really now since about Thursday.
And how long have you been out there in Barunga, Malcolm? You live there, or?
Yes, I've been here 7 years. Yes. And I just wanted to let you know that the floodwaters, how quickly they rise and fall. The rain comes up into the headlands on the very rocky ground, and when they get the falls, it just flows unbelievably. Down into the rivers, and it rises and falls just as quickly.
A natural event is an amazing thing to observe, isn't it, Malcolm? It's just wonderful to see it rise and fall, and a big storm, a lightning strike, you know, even a drought. Just the natural world is just, it's very grounding, if I can say that, if you know what I mean.
Well, the thunderstorms we have have up here usually in October, November, December, are just so spectacular, and I'm sure you've had other people pass on that message. And I know you were in Darwin recently, but the thunderstorms out this way, they just come on and they just go and go forever, and it is very spectacular. But the whole thing about the territory is spectacular as well. I mean, the contrasts between here and the southern states, and I'm up from Tassie, so you can imagine the difference lifestyle for me from Tasmania.
Exactly. Malcolm, go on.
Yeah, no, you go.
No, I'm right. I'm just looking at my clock. That's all. I've got to get out of it.
Okay. All right. Okay, look, I just wanted to say that it is quite dramatic here, and some people are really suffering, especially in Katherine, and that bridge did peak at 19.2. So hopefully it's steady now and we'll start to slowly recede.
Good on you, Malcolm. Great to talk to you. We'll talk again.
Okay. Thanks, Macon.
Bye. That if you want to get hold of that book, it's called The Big Beat of the 50s. It's just fabbo. Pictures and stories about Bill Haley and Johnny Burnett and Hank Garland and all sorts of people, and Col Joy, and I think Digger gets a copy, actually. I've got an address here for ARIS, which is the Australian Rock and Roll Appreciation Society. That's all of us. 12 Gibbs Road, Montrose, Victoria. 12 Gibbs Road, Montrose, Victoria, to ARIS. Listen, thanks for your company this morning. Keep the cards and letters coming. Stay tuned. Local radio, great morning. There you go. I hope you enjoyed our highlights package. If you want the full Monty, listen in every Sunday morning from 5:30 till 10 and tune into Australia. If you see me on the road, stop and say g'day. Contact me at macatracks@gmail.com. Talk to you Sunday.